If we're really in love with the truth, then when we're engaged in an argument in the original sense of that word, we're seeking to make things clear and we're trying to sharpen one another and we're open to coming to a different position that we start with because we want to love the truth. So arguments are helpful to two people who start with differing views. If they both love truth, they'll both rejoice in the end, even when one has to yield. And I think that's lacking even in the church, sadly.
On this edition of The White Horse Inn, I'll be talking with Aaron Larson, Joel Hodge, and Christopher Perrin about taking every thought captive.
Five centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Well, hello and welcome to another edition of the White Horse Inn. In our last program, we asked the question, whatever happened to Bible study, learning the grammar of Scripture? Though we're called to be transformed by the renewing of our minds, more and more of today's Christians have replaced Bible study with all sorts of distractions, often still called Bible study. But there's another problem at another level. Even if we do get together and read and study the Scriptures, increasingly in our culture, we find that there is less and less discernment in being able to understand arguments, and certainly the Bible makes lots of arguments. Dorothy Sayers addresses this issue in her important essay, The Lost Tools of Learning, when she writes, "We let our young men and women go out unarmed in a day when armor was never so necessary. By teaching them all to read, we have left them at the mercy of the printed word. By the invention of the film and the radio, we have made certain that no aversion to reading shall secure them from the incessant battery of words. They do not know what the words mean. They are prey to words in their emotions instead of being the masters of them in their intellects. We who were scandalized in 1940 when men were sent to fight armored tanks with rifles are not scandalized when young men and women are sent into the world to fight mass propaganda with a smattering of subjects, and when whole classes and whole nations become hypnotized by the arts of a spellbinder. We have the impudence to be astonished at this." Well, how then are we to raise up the next generation of Christians to think seriously about the Christian faith, especially if many of us have not been really taught to think at all, either in public or private school or even in the church? How are we to keep, especially our children today who have all sorts of distractions, keep them in the faith if they're constantly being propagandized by countless non-Christian ideas they encounter in today's movies, television, and the world of advertising? The Apostle Paul calls us to take every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. But how is that actually accomplished? With us to discuss this important issue are Aaron Larson and Joel Hodge, the co-authors of a book titled The Art of Argument, An Introduction to the Informal Fallacies. And also joining us in this discussion is Dr. Christopher Perrin, publisher and consultant for Classical Academic Press, and someone who's also responsible for getting this book published. First of all, let's start with you, Dr. Perrin. Tell us a little bit about why you think it's so important for young people today to understand the art of argument.
One way I would answer that question is to do just what you did, was to paraphrase Dorothy Sayers. I think she very concisely summed up the chief reasons why we need to study logic. We do need to be prepared, and we are in a time when sustained and careful thought is out of vogue, mainly because of so many interesting distractions that make us cavort in a world of sound bites and images. But that makes us vulnerable, as Dorothy Sayers has pointed out, and we're seeing the fruit of that. We're seeing a generation in the church who are being bloodied and beaten up when it comes to defending and articulating the Christian faith. Another reason, though, is that we are made in the image of God. And as image bearers, we have rationality. We have minds in which we can discern and think God's thoughts after Him and make discoveries and connect truth to truth and begin to see the world as a kind of a shining, resplendent whole. And that kind of coherence is being lost as well. And it's creating fatigue, and it's creating a kind of ennui or depression and some drifting and hopelessness. And that's infected the church to some degree as well.
Yeah, one thing I want to add to what Chris was saying, there's a process that unfolds in a person's education, and it's very natural. One of the things that, you know, we have noticed, and it probably will surprise absolutely no one out there, but, you know, as educators, we've taken a particular note of this, that teenagers love to argue.
And that's not a new thing, is it?
No. There's nothing, absolutely nothing new about that. Maybe something new about the degree and the intensity to which our culture bombards us with arguments. But the fact that teenagers have this natural bent to get down beneath the surface of things to understand why something's important or why they should be obedient in this, that, or the other thing, that is actually a fairly natural process. And so it's actually a good idea, we think, to try to take that tendency and unpack that and make that a part of their education so that we can, instead of cutting against the grain, cutting with the grain, so that we're making use of that natural tendency to do something useful and help them learn how to argue, how to identify bad arguments. When we make this a built-in part of their education, it actually helps them to be a little less argumentative about irrelevant things because they're exercising those muscles to do something useful.
So it's actually taking advantage of this stage of life where it's actually a divinely given part of our development as human beings that we're asking questions, we're looking for connections, and why not channel that in a good direction, a healthy direction? What happens very often in church settings, in youth groups at this particular stage that maybe undermines that?
You're asking good questions. I agree with Chris and Aaron, absolutely. There is this natural inclination for young people to be inquisitive and to ask questions. And I think very often as Christians and within the Christian community, we bristle at some of that. And in some ways we very rightly ought to help guide and instruct, but I don't think we ought to do that out of fear of the question, out of fear of the content of what they're discussing. And I think that's where parents and educators very often within the Christian community get hung up, is that when a student wants to try on an idea and it's not the right idea, we very quickly want to stop that, end it, and, you know, make sure that they know what the right answer is, instead of taking them through the process of training them how to think and ask the questions to let them discover what the right answer is so they can actually own the right answer at the end of the day. And when you just want to make sure that they get the right answer down on paper or they get the right answer, you know, coming out of their mouths, and you can control their behavior to a certain degree so that you're seeing them behave like a good person, you're seeing them act like a good Christian young man or young woman, and they're saying all the right things. But internally, if they haven't really digested it and gone through the process of considering the questions, identifying where the fallacies are and the bad arguments, identifying what the right arguments ought to be, then when they do meet up with somebody who presses them someday, they have no backbone to stand on. They have no foundation to really corroborate what they're thinking because, well, that's just the right answer, and they have nothing beyond that. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think logic serves to do.
Do you think that without that kind of armor, as Sayers talks about it, we're not only prey to advertisers, but also to this kind of emotional bullying when we get to college where our professor is the expert and we can't really evaluate the arguments and the evidence. We haven't been given those tools. And so we basically shrug and say, well, he or she is the expert on this, and we take a back seat. Do you think that this is really preparing a whole generation for mass slaughter?
I think we endanger the next generation to the degree that we don't train them in the art of discernment, thinking, and logic. And this would apply even to those outside of the church. Everyone should be trained to exercise reason well. And there's a centuries-long tradition of training in this art, and it's considered an art because it's not really a subject. It's a means of mastering any subject. And the entire population suffers from not being able to think, from a lack of sustained argumentation for, very short attention spans. Right now we're going through the election season, and the political speech and the advertisements and the commentary are just rife with fallacious sound bites, and they come at us so fast that people are just worn out, and they're looking for the biggest flash to impress them and so on. So what we need to return to is really the education of our humanity, the cultivation of human beings again, not just to do certain things, but to be a certain kind of person. And as Jolie was speaking, I was thinking of that. Someone said somewhere that the truth is not afraid of a free and fair fight. And the only way that the next generations of Christians is going to believe and understand that is for them to go through the exercises of seeing the truth being very well able to defend itself.
Michael, you sort of alluded to a question when a student is sitting in a class and, are they asking, are they considering what the professor is really saying? I think we may give too much credit to students these days to think that they are sitting and questioning what a professor or a teacher is saying very often. I think most times they are looking to jot down what the answers are and to put them in their notebooks so that they can get it right on the test. I think we need to take even one further step back and consider that we need to teach students and teach young people how to hear what's being said and simultaneously be thinking of what are the right questions to be asking myself right now. When we used to teach, I used to tell the students to sort of block off one side of their paper with, for notes and everything that they needed to write down during a lecture, but then on the side of the paper to be questioning, why is this true? How do we know this? Where is this information coming from? Is it valid information? And then taking it the next step further and seeing what the domino effect might be from it. And that's a lot to ask of a student, and not all of them got it all of the time, but training them and teaching them to be always asking questions so they aren't just becoming sponges for information. There's a difference, between just acquiring information so they can regurgitate it back and actually learning how to think. And we've really lost that component of education and thinking about what somebody is saying.
How much of this is a shift to individualistic subjectivism? It's basically when we don't have good arguments, we can only appeal to our own experience. And so we try to persuade people, and we find in the process that it's not persuasive because they haven't had the same experience.
You're getting at, I think, one of the big components of a postmodern world, and that is this ultimate individualism that we walk around. I mean, we have iPods, iPhones, everything. Everything's about me. And so everything becomes relative to my experience. Well, that isn't true for me, or that wasn't my experience. We've lost the whole notion of universal truth. That's not real thinking. We need to start guiding back to what is real and true reason instead of what is my own personal opinion on a particular matter.
Mm-hmm. It's a fundamental problem that we have to keep addressing, this subjectivism that seems to be reigning so well. It's self-refuting, so we can address that. To say there's no truth is just to assert a truth. But people, I think, are also playing a kind of language game with themselves, which is another kind of fallacy, a fallacy of clarity. Because everyone is interested, most everyone will admit, they're interested in knowing what reality is. They want to know what is real. But to know what is real is to know something that is true. And so the study of logic is really a way that we try to understand what the true state of affairs are. And I think most people are using logic. Everyone's using logic. The trouble is we're just not using it well. We don't know how to use the tool well. And most students, when they are given some training and can see how the tool can be sharpened and be used well, find it very enjoyable and want to continue doing it. So the book, The Art of Argument, is about studying how argument can go wrong so that you can make arguments go well. And by kind of walking in the shoes of these 28 fallacies in The Art of Argument, students begin to recognize not just others around them, but they begin to recognize themselves. Because as human beings, we're all so fallen. We bear the image of God, but we're fallen. And so we're all tempted by fallacies. We're tempted to use our own experience as a proof, for example, as the only proof. We're tempted to bifurcate, and we're sometimes tempted to commit ad hominem fallacies and name-calling. Christians do this too. So the church needs to study the fallacies as a means of repentance, not just as a means of countering attacks.
Boy, that's such an important point, especially when you see so many calls to wisdom, discernment, prudence, answering people with kindness, preaching the truth in love, lots and lots of biblical commands to think clearly and to articulate truth clearly, defend the truth, and to do it in a winsome and gentle manner. This is not just an intellectual head game we're talking about. This is about virtue, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And I think that really is the first place to start in training young students in logic, is to start with humility and a love of wisdom. Because that sets our heart and mind in the right orientation and trajectory, which is to be a servant, not to be an argument winner, not to beat back the enemy and beat the opposition. It's the love of truth, the love of goodness and beauty as well, and the love of other people, and the love of wisdom. That's what makes, I think, logic become very powerful in the church, is when it's exercised by people who truly are speaking truth in love and out of love and for the love of others.
Well, let's go through some of those fallacies. And let me say, first of all, that this book, The Art of Argument, An Introduction to the Informal Fallacies, is really something I might use in my seminary classes. It's written for younger students, but I never got this in high school. I think that this is something that pastors and Sunday school teachers and parents, as well as young people, need to learn. Let's go through some of these fallacies, and we're going to recognize some of the arguments that we've made this past week in these fallacies. Could you run us through, first of all, ad hominem fallacies?
Yeah, before I get to the specifics of the fallacies, we talk about the analogy of equipping students with the right kind of armor before we send them out into battle, and the best kind of armor is always a flexible armor. We need to equip them so that they have the flexibility to deal with the kinds of, you know, insanity that bombards us all the time in the modern world. So getting down to the specifics, one of the first things that I thought would be helpful to address is the whole category of ad hominem arguments, because, number one, it's one of the most easy to identify fallacies. So you start with something that's very clear. Kids are quite familiar with, you know, little brother arguing with them by saying, you're a meanie head, they can get that pretty quickly.
Just to make a comment about that, Michael, briefly, we did want to start with some fallacies that students quickly understood, almost could intuit, and then take them through to some more complicated fallacies slowly. But another reason why we thought we needed a book on informal logic is that students do immediately see its purpose and usefulness. There's a kind of immediate ability to apply the principles of informal logic in their lives that students normally really enjoy. They start using it at the dinner table. A 13-year-old who's learning logic is very willing to catch his grandpa in a fallacy and announce it to the entire table. So they begin to play with this new skill, and they enjoy it, and they see its usefulness to them. So that's another great reason for, you know, say, 12, 13, 14-year-olds to start with logic. But as you say, even seminary students need it. If they haven't had it, they need this tool to be sharpened as well. But I think Aaron very wisely took these three larger principles of relevance, presumption, and clarity and used them as organizing principles. So we devolved into asking students four questions to help them to use the tool of informal logic. The first question being, what is the key question? What is the issue, at hand? What is the key issue? Because we quickly can get off topic. And then once that issue has been defined, ask three additional questions, even if they're asked internally. Is the argument that I'm hearing relevant to that issue? If it's not, it might be a fallacy of relevance. Is the argument I'm hearing presuming something or assuming something that's illegitimate, a kind of hidden premise or assumption? If so, it could be a fallacy of presumption. And is the argument clear? And if it's not clear, it might be violating the principle of clarity, another kind of fallacy. Julie, do you want to comment about how you teach the book using those categories as a way of giving students the entire landscape?
Those four questions are really the backbone for rational thought. And it's something that we sort of forget to do unless we are trained to do it. I mean, how often is it that you see two people who start off having a disagreement about a particular issue, and then the argument devolves into just, you know, an all-out disruption of their social circle or whatever it might be, because they've lost track of that line of what the actual issue was all the way through. And students do that when the pattern of that is not trained at home very often. They, you know, we see that developing in how they relate to one another, how they relate to their parents, how they relate to their teachers, and so forth. But the broader issue with that is that when it comes to learning subjects, whether it be science or mathematics or literature or history or whatever the discipline might be, they are so undisciplined in how they think that they allow themselves to be taken on whatever trail, whatever journey, whichever author is writing about it, or whatever professor or teacher they have. And it's really about training the mind to stay on task and to be in charge of and in control of what they're allowing themselves to believe and what they're allowing themselves to accept as truth. And it is a discipline and a training that has to start. And students very often don't know what questions to ask themselves. They don't know that they should be sitting and thinking when they're hearing an authority tell them something, you know, about a particular discipline. So this is really the cornerstone for developing mature, rational thought for an adult. And it takes practice and consistency and reminding them throughout all of their courses that you need to come back and ask those four questions. What is the real issue? Is the argument that is being made relevant? Is it presumptive or assuming something? And is it clear? And start with those every single time they hear or, you know, digest information of any kind.
You think of the Lincoln-Douglas debates. A lot of people keep going back to that example, but where people were willing to stand or sit, and we're talking about farmers here, we're not talking about philosophers, for 4 or 5 hours to listen to reasoned arguments on both sides, and people could follow it, versus young people growing up today with their elders modeling basically every ad hominem argument in the book on Fox and MSNBC on the left and the right, where people are just yelling at each other. They're not making arguments. They're really talking about whether they have a feel-good sense for the personal life of that candidate.
I think you're right. We're seeing that increasingly happen. You're reminding me of G.K. Chesterton's comment that his principal objection to a quarrel is that perhaps it ends a good argument.
And, that's nice.
And I think a lot of those farmers who were listening to the Lincoln-Douglas debates were also enjoying themselves, because when you've been trained in an art, any art, and have acquired some degree of mastery of it, there is a wonderful joy and pleasure in exercising that art. And there's a wonderful pleasure in exercising one's mind when it has been trained to discern truth from error. It's a pleasure. Just like learning a language, you know, learning Latin or Greek or Hebrew or French or Spanish takes a good amount of training and work. But the pleasure of someone who can travel to Barcelona and speak fluently in another language is a wonderful pleasure that is worth the training. And we have a generation that doesn't know that pleasure any longer. Mm. We were made to seek after truth and find it. And we love naming the animals. We love discovering truth and beauty and goodness. And to the degree that our educational system now is saying those things don't matter, we're depriving people of the great pleasure not only of being a Christian, but even of being a human.
Yeah. Let's go through in that light, just to give people a taste. First of all, what I really like is you give examples, even advertisements. Here is one for ad hominem arguments. A better man for the people, with a picture of the candidate for council chairman. And then we read the endorsement. A vote for incumbent Sam Turnpaugh is a tragic mistake. That dirty dog isn't worth putting back in the office, much less the doghouse he deserves. Sam acts like he's still in kindergarten. Why would we reelect him? Now, you hear a lot of really silly, trivial, juvenile attacks like that in the political arena these days. How is that ad hominem, and how do we hear that not only in political circles, but even in the church?
It strikes me that they're getting more and more blatant with these things. I mean, you know, okay, you can argue that a lot of the stuff that is true about politicians is not necessarily relevant or the main issue, I just think recently of the, you know, Mitt Romney is a felon who killed my wife. Advertisements that have just been out there in the last couple months. You know, whatever you think of Mitt Romney, it's pretty clear that he didn't have anything to do with a poor woman's cancer, you know. But it works for a certain percentage of the people, and that's the unfortunate thing about it.
Or that President Obama is a Muslim.
Yeah, well, that too. The thing is that it doesn't need to work for very many people. They can just peel off a small percentage of the people that are just turned off by the sheer nastiness of it, then they might have won. And that's a very unfortunate situation.
So what you're saying is, here's a classic example of how basically the democratic process is being undermined. People are becoming cynical of the whole democratic process precisely because, in large part, ad hominem arguments rather than real arguments are taking center stage.
Well, you know, isn't it sort of a tragedy that presidential elections can be won and lost based off of 30-second commercial sound bites? You know, if the majority of people are getting their political cues of what to believe and how what's happened and what's truth and what each candidate stands for, if they're collecting their data based off of a 30-second commercial, that's where part of the disservice comes in. Because, you know, the politicians and their campaigners know that they have 30 seconds to introduce an idea, wrap it up, and make their candidate look as good as possible. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's the real shame of it, that they have to boil down their arguments to these tiny, insignificant fallacies, and we allow them to do it, and you know that's just what Americans are, you know, have been trained to expect.
Mm-hmm. And tragically, we see that we're playing itself out also in the church these days. As we sort of hit these quickly, appeals to emotion. What are some examples of appeals to emotion?
You mentioned the church, Michael, and I'm thinking of how chronological snobbery can be used in the church either to be hip and cool or to just be traditional, and then you can fall into fallacies and errors in either direction.
When the real question is, what is the truth?
Exactly. And mob appeal would be another example. I'm thinking of youth ministries, where so many youth ministries are just, we want to be like everybody else. We want to be able to have the same kind of entertainment, the same kind of look, the same refreshments and so forth. So youth ministry is that looks a lot like what you see in popular culture, generally. And there's a sense in which we just want to conform. And you know, the boiled down version of that is, well, everybody is doing this.
Well, you even hear theologians sometimes say things like, well, how can a confession that was written 500 years ago, much less a creed that was written 1500 years ago, continue to reflect our beliefs in this time and place, as if the confession that Jesus rose from the dead on the third day somehow is materially affected by the fact that we now have Lean Cuisine dinners?
Yeah, the key is that the eternal truths are really what we should be grounding ourselves on. And so there should be something that hasn't changed for 1,500 years. There would be certainly something wrong with our creed if we couldn't say that there was something there that had been unchanged for 1,500 years. And yes, perhaps we need new confessional statements from time to time to deal with the new fallacies that have popped up. In the meantime, that doesn't make the older statements any less true or any less important.
I was just going to add, the appeals to emotion, I think, are particularly the nasty fallacies, or they can be. And the reason why I say that is that, you know, we all walk around as human beings with emotions, obviously, and we experientially feel like what we feel is obviously valid. There are very few of us who think that we get upset unnecessarily, that we find, you know, joy in things that we ought not find joy in. I mean, usually we are particularly validated in what we feel. An emotional appeal resonates with us instantaneously, and in most cases, we don't even know that it's happened. And those mm-hmm. emotional fallacies and being able to identify how we might be being manipulated and how we are being manipulative ourselves when we craft our own arguments, I think is critical to becoming, you know, men and women who follow Christ first and who are possessed by truth and not ruled by what we feel. And mm-hmm. that's a really big pitfall that not just students but adults find themselves into.
Mm-hmm. As we go through some of the others, I'd like to get to red herrings and particularly straw man arguments. What is a straw man argument?
Well, the straw man argument is where you create a caricature of your opponent's point of view. What's really so wrong about straw man fallacy? version of the opponent's argument that's not real, and thus it's much easier to defeat.
And often it's combined with an ad hominem, because often when your argument is translated into something poor and inaccurate, it's a way of name-calling as well.
So really, this gets again at the question of virtue, and especially Christian character, where we are commanded all over the place to protect our neighbor's name and reputation, not to lie. You know, I tell my students in class very often, now when you get ready to write your papers, I want this to be a paper that the opponent in your paper could read and say, at least he or she got my position correct. That's what I believe. That's what I hold. Only then do you earn the right to pick at his or her argument. And I fear that a lot of times what we get, and sometimes even from the pulpit, are these straw man arguments where it's very easy to beat up a straw man. That's why it's called a straw man. It's not a real opponent.
Mm-hmm. And what's needed, of course, is, as you pointed out, love. Loving your neighbor as yourself and considering his interests more important than your own. And to do that takes some time, it takes patience, and it takes humility. It means admitting that perhaps you might be wrong. But if we're really in love with the truth, then when we're engaged in an argument in the original sense of that word, we're seeking to make things clear, and we're trying to sharpen one another, and we're open to coming to a different position than we start with, because we want to love the truth. So that's what I think Chesterton meant when he said he doesn't like quarrels because they end good arguments, because arguments are helpful to two people who start with differing views. If they both love truth, they'll both rejoice in the end, even when one has to yield. And I think that's lacking even in the church, sadly.
Absolutely. Yeah, if you have a good argument, then even if I don't agree, at least we're not raising our voices in emotion at each other, trading our subjective attacks. We're actually saying, I understand where you're coming from, and you make a good argument there. I'm still not persuaded, but good arguments are a way of actually keeping people from fisticuffs, aren't they?
It is. You know, you're making me think about how Chesterton and George Bernard Shaw used to debate a lot, and they were ideologically on the opposite ends of the spectrum. But these men debated each other frequently and in public, but they also loved each other, and people knew it. And the kind of discourse they had was entertaining. It was sometimes very, very intense and focused on logic and analogy and a lot of other things, but they cared for one another, and that came through as well.
How about, this is one that I think we come across a lot too, the genetic fallacy.
Yeah, that's the one that, you know, you follow up the origins of an argument, an item, and use that to discredit it. You know, we're kind of maybe a little bit more used to seeing that happen with people, individuals. But the genetic fallacy kind of goes at sort of the deeper roots of an idea. You know, Christmas has pagan, papist origins, therefore it ought not to be celebrated.
Yeah, that's a big one.
Or you're only a Christian because you've been raised in a Christian home. Or, you know, of course you believe that. You went to Westminster Seminary.
Right. And it has absolutely nothing to do with the question, again, of whether it's true or false.
Exactly right. It may be that I first got this idea when I was attending Westminster Seminary. But, you know, there's another argument for the position besides the fact that I happened to hear about it at Westminster Seminary. Would you like to hear that argument and talk about it? Or can you actually dismiss it simply by talking about where I first heard the idea?
Right. Yeah. You just say that because you're a Calvinist, or you just say that because you're an Arminian.
Yeah, and linking that together with either an ad hominem attack against a particular person or historical figure has become so common that it's just sort of accepted, or linking it up with a straw man fallacy has, again, become so common that it's just sort of accepted by mainstream academia or mainstream media or the elite culture, I think creates a particularly powerful and pernicious combination. Because, you know, first you succeed in making Calvinism or Puritanism a bad word in the culture, and then you say, well, you're just being puritanical.
Yeah.
You have these layers of fallacies built on each other where, first of all, were the Puritans really how they're portrayed? And second of all, does that analogy even fit anyways?
And of course, now it takes some time to unravel that, which people don't want to give.
Right. Exactly. I mean, what you're saying with all of these fallacies is basically it's easier to be lazy, which is not to love your neighbor.
Correct. And therefore should also lead us to repentance, because then, you know, there's laziness in all of our hearts, and we need to root that out.
Yes. How about one more before we draw this to a close? One that I think is often misunderstood, begging the question. You often hear people say, for example, well, that begs the question, and then, comma, there's a question. But that's not exactly what begging the question is as a fallacy, is it?
I think you're absolutely right, Michael. People have used that as a colloquial phrase, and it's almost changed definitionally what begging the question actually means, you know, unfortunately. The idea of begging the question is that inherent within the question you're asking is an assumption of what it is you're trying to prove. The question is being posed in such a way that the very thing that you're trying to prove is assumed as truth within the context of the question.
You're almost begging that your conclusion would just be granted without you having to prove it. So you're almost begging your listener to just grant you the conclusion without solid evidence for it. But it's when, you know, the Latin word is petitio principii, which means to petition the principle. So it's almost as if you're asking that the principle be just laid aside and that you can, you know, be given a pass for having to give solid argument for your position.
Which is a little different from what Peter tells us when he says, be prepared to have an argument for everyone who asks you.
Right. And not to give an argument that sounds like an argument when it really isn't. And that's what happens with begging the question. You start making arguments that sound like arguments. They may have the kind of form of argumentation, but when you think about it, you realize there hasn't been any evidence given. There hasn't been a reason given.
Yeah, in a sense, you kind of restated the conclusion and called that a premise. There's a whole bunch of stuff that's missing, but you've used clever language that it sounds like there's more development involved than there really is.
So the proper response to begging the question, would you say, is to respond to people by saying, well, that actually is what we're debating. You're treating as a conclusion the very thing that we have yet to argue for and against.
I think exactly. So then the response should be something like, we need to actually establish that particular point. A classic example of this is in the old loaded question that assumes a conclusion in the question, like, have you stopped beating your kids yet? And the proper response is not to say yes or no. The proper response is to say, your question assumes that I either have or am continuing to abuse my children. Neither of those things is true. So would you like to ask me a different question? So we have to pull out the hidden premises.
Well, there is so much here that we could go through, and people who pick up this book may be surprised at what a page-turner it is. You don't usually think, if I pick up a logic book, I'm going to sit for a few hours and find that I've read through the whole thing. It's that kind of book, The Art of Argument, An Introduction to the Informal Fallacies. And this is the sort of thing you ought to go through with your kids who are going through that logic stage, and you can also try it out with TV advertisements and try it out with political ads and listen to political debates and try to pick things out, or ask them even when they go to church, was that clear? Was that a good argument from the text? And those things can really enrich our Christian life, not make us more argumentative, but make us better at arguing so that we don't rely on attacks on people's persons or appeals to emotion, but really are able to give good reasons for what we believe and why we believe it. Thank you all for taking the time to be with us, for writing this book, The Art of Argument. It's published by Classical Academic Press, and people can go to your website and download the first 5 chapters, I understand.
That's right, at classicalacademicpress.com. Just go to the Art of Argument page and you can download those chapters as a PDF file.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, thank you for taking the time to be with us and helping us hopefully think more clearly in the future.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. To find out how to support our efforts, give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. You can also check out the support tab of our website at whitehorseinn.org. That's whitehorseinn.org.